Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and he was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, no, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't Lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it's on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
My wife and I are out here at an old sawmill in East Texas that's been abandoned for, I don't know, 60, maybe 70 years, 50 years. I'm standing on where the sawmill used to be. It's the foundation underneath me. And we've got some of the big upright walls. And I find it interesting of how nature reclaims something after mankind has abandoned it. That the walls are gone. We've got the big oak trees. Not oak trees. Well, there's a couple of trees, but like this big pine tree. This thing must be 100 feet easy. We've got the magnolia tree right here. All growing in what used to be a busy factory. That they used to bring logs in, cut them up. For some reason, the sawmill was abandoned. And this is what remains. There's another building over there. Here's part of the wall. Whenever I walk through these remains, cannot help but think about the people that worked here, their families, how they lived, the politics at the time, their worries at the time? Did they have the same worries that we did about the kids and money and paying a house note? Where people once worked, all there is now is trees and deer and birds. By looking at this area, you would have never known it, but this is a thriving lumber town community. There were houses all through here. And all it is now is a dirt road with nothing for miles. A couple of weeks ago, my dad, my mom, my wife, and I were out riding around. My dad took us down through some of these old dirt roads, and he said, this area right here is the Rimling community. It's like Gilmer spelled backwards. And the last people moved out of this area, and at around 1960-something, 1964, 1968, I don't remember the exact year that he said, there's nothing here. Here we are 40-some-odd years later, and there's nothing here. This is what happens whenever mankind is not around to take care of things. Your buildings fall down, or they're tore down, and nature reclaims everything. Just 50 years ago, this was a thriving community, salt town, mill town area. Houses everywhere, kids going to school. Now it's nothing. Just a little bit of garbage on the side of the road, and that's it. So if you wonder, well, what's it going to be like? Let's say that some type of long-term disaster happens and 75%, 90% of mankind's wiped out. What is going to happen to our communities? And I think this, where I'm standing at, is a good example of what's going to happen to our communities. You give nature just 10, 15, 20 years, and it'll reclaim what's rightfully its, what rightfully belongs to it.
Hi everybody, I'm Florida Trailblazer, exploring in these woods by the Suwannee River. Such a beautiful place. Interesting area of history as well. You see, at one time there was a town here called Ellaville, existed in the 1800s, and in those times it was a booming area. It was founded by George Franklin Drew, who later went on to become Florida's 12th governor. And there were many industries in this area in which the town thrived on, such as logging and turpentine. The railroad was connected to the town as well. Eventually, the area was abandoned in the early 1900s, around the turn of the century. As I'm exploring through the woods today, seeing some traces from the past. See this sinkhole forming. Maybe interesting features in the area. Following this area back into the woods along the railroad line, you can see it here. And it was in use long ago during the times of Ellaville, and still is in use today. seeing some remains here. Some pieces of metal, different cans. I'm seeing some glass, bricks around the area. Very interesting area here. This may have been where some of the homesteads in the town were located. Seeing some ruins in this part of the woods. Now, this may have been part of a homestead site. Not positive, but there was a structure here at one time. It's nice to see some of the remains out here. Remnants from the past. Takes you back to another time. See some more foundations in the area. Some bamboo trees planted out here. Wow, this is really interesting. There's some old remains here in the woods. Been out here for quite some time.
The South today is really not much different than the rest of the country. But the Old South, that's another story in what the Rosewood Massacre is all about. 60 years ago, Rosewood in North Florida was a thriving little community of about 200 people, almost all of them black. Early in January 1923, some 1,000 whites came to town, and when they left about a week later, Rosewood had been burned to the ground. No one knows for sure how many people were killed there. The figures might be as high as 40. For 60 years, the story of Rosewood remained secret and was only uncovered recently by Florida newspaper man Gary Moore, who is writing a book on the massacre at Rosewood.
Rosewood. There's a road sign proclaiming its name, but no memorial commemorating its dead. Located 9 miles from the Gulf of Mexico at Cedar Key, Florida, Rosewood today is little more than a trailer park. You search in vain for any sign of a slaughter, for any hint of the mass murder that took place here a long time ago.
Well, what did it look like?
It's a big blaze. You've seen things on fire. A big blaze. It's burning down. This burning up the whole thing. This burning up my grandmama's house, churches, and everything. They burn up everything we had. All our clothes and everything. Yeah. They burned it up.
Why did they burn everything?
They was mad.
But you were just little children.
I know it. What did we care? They didn't care. They killed us. I was about 8 years old.
Minnie Lee Langley was only a child when she became a refugee. Now, she's a great-grandmother. At her home in Jacksonville, Florida, we talked to her about the place where she was born, Rosewood, Florida, the place that haunts her memory.
I know they killed my aunt, and they killed my granddaddy. Made my granddaddy dug his hole. He didn't have but one arm, but they made him dug his own grave. And he prayed, and they shot him back within the grave.
At Rosewood.
At Rosewood.
This is where it all began, in the white settlement of Sumner, just a few miles from Rosewood. Sumner disappeared in the late 1920s when a fire destroyed the sawmill. But back in 1923, Sumner was a booming little company town. James and Fanny Taylor had a home not far from here. On the morning of January 1st, 1923, James Taylor was already at work at the sawmill when neighbors said they heard his wife Fanny screaming for help. Fanny told her neighbors that a man had entered her home and attacked her, a black man.
She opened the door, but he just knocked her down, and she was raped.
Edith Foster was 16 years old at the time. She remembers seeing the few hundred white men of Sumner joined by others from surrounding counties, even from out of state. She remembers how they grew into a mob seeking revenge.
If he hadn't ever went in on this white lady, you know, well, there'd never been nothing to it.
It's not known for sure who attacked Fanny Taylor. Some whites say it was Sylvester Carrier, a young, strong-willed black man from Rosewood. Some blacks say the attacker was a white man. They say it was Fanny Taylor's boyfriend. But a lot of people tend to think the attacker was a black convict who had escaped from a nearby chain gang. Whoever he was, he touched off a week-long killing party.
They just, a bad crew come in here, and they just wiped it off of the map.
That night, around about 9 o'clock or 8:30, there they come in a car.
They kept looking for this Sylvester, but they didn't seem to find him. And then they went back up there that night and to talk to his mother.
Called him for my aunt, saying, Sarah, Sarah, Sarah. And so my aunt didn't say nothing because she was scared too.
And that's when all the shooting began, you see.
And with the shooting all in the house, all upstairs in the windows.
These colored folks, you know, they were ready for it.
And I was sitting right between his legs. And he had the gun over to my right shoulder.
This was Sylvester?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got down on him, and these old white people busted the door down. When they busted the door down, that's when he dropped them. He just dropped everyone come to the door.
He shot them?
Yeah.
Well, they killed Mr. Anders before he got to the house. They loaded him with a buckshot right here. Killed him dead. They had to leave him there.
At least two white men were killed that night, forcing the mob to retreat. It was then that the black women and children, 12 or 13 of them, ran from the bullet-riddled Carrier home and into the woods. Minnie Lee Langley, 8 years old at the time, ran with them.
We had an aunt with us, so Scrappy. She was just like a hen with a nest of biddies. She taken us to the woods. Kept us out in the woods. She kept us out in the woods almost a week.
There's swamps out there.
Well, we stayed in there. Took it like a soldier and stayed out there in the woods.
You went through those swamps?
Yes, we went all out in the woods. And she built a little bit of fire for us to stay warm because it was so cold at night.
In the morning, the mob returned several hundred strong. Inside the Carrier home, they found Sarah, Sylvester's mother. She was dead. They also found
another body, a black man. Some people say it was Sylvester, but no one really knows for sure. What we do know is what happened next. The mob set the Carrier home on fire, and they watched it burn. And then that mob grew in size, it grew in anger, and it became even more violent.
You ain't never seen a mob like that.
Fred Kirkland was a teenager when he saw the mob rampaging through Rosewood.
They went wild. There were 1,000 to 1,500 people there by that time, and they're coming in from every direction. And they was crazy. They give the high sheriff and the deputy 5 minutes to get out of sight and not come back.
They told the sheriff and the deputy to get out of town and not come back?
Get out of there. Give them 5 minutes to get out of sight.
And what did the sheriff and the deputy do?
They left there. And then they went to burning houses, killing people. You never seen.
Yeah, Sunday morning they came through here, you know, setting houses on fire. And as each one ran out, they'd shoot them, kill them. And there was a colored woman right here, lived just across here in the woods from me. And her name was Lexi Gordon. And she was sick. She had typhoid fever. And when she told her, the ones that were staying there with her, for them to go ahead and get away if they could, well, she'd just take whatever come, you know. Well, naturally, when they set the house on fire, well, she ran out and ran out towards the back. And she had a back door, Johnny, you know, out there. And so she made for it. And they shot her before she got there.
But she had nothing to do with it
at all, whatever. And, it was a way with a lot of them, you see. That's the reason it was such a situation that we just couldn't understand. It was just a mad bunch of men come in here.
What do you think they got out of it? Why did they do it?
Motive, I guess. Satisfaction is all I can figure it out. I don't know what it was.
Satisfaction.
I reckon that was it.
Well, the whole place was in smoke around here, you know. And they said they had destroyed all the buildings. And said that there would be no more to live here no more, you know. They couldn't come back and live.
Miss Langley, would you go back to Rosewood with us?
I would go that y'all don't let them bother me or nothing like that. I don't want to go there and get hurt or nothing.
Yeah.
You remember?
Hello, darling.
We brought Minnie Lee Langley back to Rosewood for the first time in 60 years. We also asked Lee Ruth Davis, Leroy Carrier, and Sam Hall, all survivors of Rosewood, to come back for a day.
Oh. Hello, Sammy.
Hey. You remember her, Mr. Hall? Yeah. Oh, she looked
just up
for this
Marcy. Yeah. Oh, Lord, yeah. This is Marcy.
Was that they used to call you?
That's what they call me, Marcy.
She
yeah.
looked just like Miss Virginia.
Yeah,
your mom.
My mother.
Yeah.
I'm bringing back memories that I wished I could get rid of. You know what I mean? This has been a horror. If you just had been here to listen to all this and see some of it, then you would have known just what it was. We lost everything.
You own the land.
Yeah, we own our land, all of them.
And no one ever paid you any money for this land?
No.
You just lost it.
Took it.
What do you say to children today? Children like this boy, like your great-grandson, and people who didn't grow up when you grew up, mm-hmm. and people who didn't go through what you went through, people who would say, this couldn't have happened in this country. Come on.
I would tell them like this. I said, don't ever stay in a place that white folks can surround it. Don't never stay in a place that white folks can surround it. Because if anything happens somewhere else, they'll run you out from your home, just like they did us.
Not many whites lived in Rosewood at that time, really just a handful. Among the few who did live here was a man by the name of John Wright, who owned the general store. John Wright lived in this house. It's one of the few that has survived. To blacks in Rosewood, John Wright was a hero. He opened his home to many of the women and children who were hiding from that mob. And John Wright did even more. He was able to get a message to the railroad that said, "The town is on fire, send a train." And that's how many blacks escaped from Rosewood, by train.
Who was on the train? You were on the train?
I was on the train. I'll never forget it. It was night when when the train come there. It was 4 o'clock. When we left, Mr. Wright.
4 o'clock in the morning?
That's right. And he told him, conductor, to pull the train on the stop anywhere on the road that he saw women and children, but not men, because they didn't know who the men would be.
If it hadn't been for this house.
We wouldn't have been here, because we wouldn't have had nowhere to hide.
Rosewood. You won't find an accurate account of it in any history book. Yet, about 40 people were killed here one terrifying week 60 years ago. When you think about it, far greater atrocities have happened elsewhere in the world. But Rosewood belongs to America. It's a real American horror story. The wonder is that it stayed secret so long. Minnie Lee Langley never even told her family.
I didn't want them to know that I was scouting through the woods to stay out there all night long, out there in that coal and all that stuff. I didn't
Running for your life?
Running, trying to save my life. I didn't want them to know just how I come along, you know, through all of this and what the white folks had did to us, because I thought it was really mean. What they did to us was mean and did it without a cause.
I read an article in Esquire magazine about the Rosewood incident, and I saw it. It was on a newsstand. It was on a newsstand in Robinson. Robinson and Beverly. And I opened up Esquire. I used to go to newsstands late at night and not buy the magazine. I just read the articles in the magazine. I just leave it up there. Not that I was cheap, but just like, I ended up just going, you know, just out of lark and reading it. So I read this article, and it's not that I didn't think anything of it. I just like, that's just terrible, right? And then John Peters, who actually was running the studio when I did Boys in the Hood, but he ended up coming out of that deal at Sony, he bought the rights to the Esquire article. So John Peters called me up and said, "I bought the rights to this thing. I want to do it with you." And so I looked at it again, and then he sent me down to Florida. And mind you, this is the first time I'd ever been around people who actually had been victims of, like, you know, of historical institutionalized racism. I've been down to the South before on trips and stuff. They send black kids down South a little bit for the summer or something. But to actually be there with people, these people were at the time they were in their 70s and 80s, some in the 90s. And they were telling me the stories about what happened, you know, in 1922, when their town was like burned, and, you know, that land was taken away from them. People were murdered and killed, you know, by this incident, Rosewood incident. And I was like, whoa, you know, I was floored by it. I originally had planned to do this other picture that Frank Price bought the rights for me for a book called Makes Me Wanna Holler, which I still want to do. And so I was like thinking, okay, this is interesting and stuff, right? And I'm leaving, talking to these people, and mind you, the younger generation stopped me. Now, mind you, they're in their 80s and 90s, so the younger generation is like in their 60s, right? The 50s and 60s. And there's these like thick black women, you know, they got the big old arms and stuff like this and this, like the, you know, the big mama arms. And this one woman, I forget her name, she's an aunt and stuff, right? She's like, "Baby, you gonna do the movie, right?" I said, "Well, ma'am, I gotta get back to L.A. and I gotta look it over the stuff and I gotta like think about it and everything, because I'm still thinking maybe I'll do Make Some Holler and maybe I'll figure this out." And then she says, she pushes me with all her, with all the boobs and arms and everything out of the corner. She says, no. I'm saying, no, success. She says, baby, you have to do this movie. This is, you have to do, if you don't do this movie, it's not going to be, the story's not going to be told. You have to do this movie. She says, listen. I said, okay, ma'am. He says, I'm trying to get past her, you know, and these big old boobs and arms and stopping me and stuff. She says, listen, either you do this movie or Steven Spielberg's going to do the movie, and we don't want him. That's for me, right? And I said, okay, ma'am, right? So then I go and I look at the article, I look at the old newspaper accounts, and then I started reading about how there were several soldiers coming back from World War One, and they were black men who fought, you know, they were the first ones who actually fought outside of the country, you know, for the freedom of this country. And their exposure to Europe and fighting the Germans and everything, you know, changed them mentally to have to come back to deal with institutionalized racism in the South. And so, and there's just always this falsehood within American historical records and everything like this, that black people were so benign in their persecution. And I've always hated that because, you know, in my family, you know, they tell stories about, you know, we didn't always get our ass kicked. You fought back, you had to move. That's why a lot of people, the Great Migration, you know, when all this stuff, it was not just the Great Depression. You have people who are persecuted economically together, poor whites and blacks, there's going to be some stuff, right? Some shit happening. So a lot of people went up to Chicago and New York, but within those skirmishes of the institutionalized racism, there were rapes, there were murders, there were assaults against children, and black people didn't all just take that shit. They fought back, you know what I mean? So, but they you know, the white mainstream never writes about that. So, and I just said, you know what? I know that this happens. My grandparents and great-grandparents know this happens, that people fought back. If there's a character in here that's from the, that's come back from the war, I can find a kind of a sense of things of some type of resonance with contemporary audiences that is historically based in fact, that I can put within the story, because that's what they were saying in the accounts. It says some of the World War One veterans were fighting back once their families were being murdered. And so that, you know, that's how that came about, the character of man that I got Bing Rames to play. Marion Doherty, who is a classic casting director, she did a lot of movies with George Roy Hill, and she did so many different pictures over time. She discovered she did Midnight Cowboy with John Schlesinger. Marion Doherty and her associates. She was in New York for many, many years, right? We're trying to figure out who else is going to be in the picture, and she says, "Why not John Voight?" And I was like, "Wow, you know," because John had taken a hiatus. So John comes in, he has a meeting with me, and we're sitting there sizing each other up. And I'm like, I'm fucking sitting here with John Voight. I'm like, wow, from Coming Home to Midnight Cowboy to a great movie that he did, Runaway Train. I think he was nominated for Best Actor for that too, Andrzej Konchalowski. And, you know, we're just talking and stuff. And so we went, me, Bing Rames, John Voight, and Don Cheadle. We went down to the South and we went up making this movie. And we took 2 or 3 acres and we built 2 towns. We carved out both of these towns out of swampland. We moved houses. We set up a mile length of railroad track. We airlifted a vintage train from the 20s and put it on there, on the track and everything and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And we made the town of Sumner, which was the white town, which was a company town, which was based on the lumber industry and the cedar mill industry and stuff, right? So the company actually owned the homes of the people. They owned the store. They kept those people, and you know, the white people kept in economic persecution. You know, I mean, they had to work at this company, and the company would just keep them in debt. And then you had the black town of Rosewood, where because it was segregated, they basically were subsistence livers. They had to grow their own food. They had their own livestock. You know, they could sell. I guess it was Yeah, they had a little bit of cedar, and they said, mm-hmm. think of the turpentine. They made turpentine and stuff. And because, and they weren't rich, but they had their own thing, there was this economic tension. So what I was trying to do was show people that, you know, that a lot of this stuff in terms of, it all goes back to the old Richard Pryor joke, a lot of this tension comes not just from the differences of how people look, but also people having assumptions of well, like the character says, like, you know, like, why does that nigga have a piano and I don't have one, right? Mr. Cumner, who's the rich white guy on the hill who's fucking everybody, he has a piano, you know, and that nigga got one, I don't got a piano. Mm-hmm. So that's what racism mm-hmm. is. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, it's just like who's got a one-upsmanship on anybody? Yep. And so you put in that and an undercurrent of that, and you have a kind of combustibility. So you have even more of a moral conundrum on it. And I think that that's what makes that picture more profound, because it's not the broad strokes of villainy and the shades of gray, of right and wrong and mm-hmm. whatever.
All right. Today's It's My House. Getting organized here. Sawmill Towns, Rosewood, Florida Revisited. Sawmill Towns, Rosewood, Florida Revisited. I often talk about black townships, and black townships were historically black townships, at least, or towns or communities that were, many were municipalities, not all, but many, that were set up by former slaves. And you have quite a few of them that still exist. Now, there were also another type of town, some that were historically black towns, but some probably more accessible by white folks, and then some were integrated. And they were known as sawmill towns. And essentially a sawmill town is really simplified just what it says. Is these, in order to earn an income, these people set up a town, or what should I say, a business, or established a town that was based in the sawmill business. And many of those towns, that was the purpose of starting the town, and some of those towns might exist today, but a lot of them are not existing. But anyway, sawmill towns, there was a proliferation of them in the United States at a particular time. Now, Rosewood, Florida, town that was started by both black and white folks. A lot of people thought it was a black township, although it became predominantly black, but historically it started by both black and white folks. And you can sort of say it was a sawmill town as well. There's another town that was not too far from it, which was prosperous at the time, Ellaville, Florida. Ellaville, Florida is a ghost town in Florida today, near the Shawnee River State Park in Swanee County, Florida. It was founded. Now, Ellaville, Florida, here's what I'm reading about this today. Ellaville, Florida was founded in 1861 by George Franklin Drew, a successful businessman and future governor of the state of Florida. Franklin decided to build a mansion on the western banks of the Swanee River. The town was named Ellaville for honoring one of his slaves named Ella. And that's why I'm mentioning that today. At one time, It counted a population of 500 people. No, it got up to 1,000 people at its peak. All right, but it did have commerce in the form of logging, turpentine logging, and sawmill activities. But that was a town named after a slave. Ella, we don't have Ella's last name. It could be Ella Drew. I mean, her master's name was Drew. But Ellaville, Florida, which is in Suwanee County, Florida. And I'm familiar with that neck of the woods. Getting back to Rosewood, something in one of the audios that we played, because Rosewood happened about 3 years after, Rosewood Massacre happened 3 years after the Black Wall Street incident. She mentioned that one of the lessons learned that she learned, one of the takeaway lessons that she learned was, don't live in a community that is surrounded by white folks. And once again, now, and they didn't have internet back then, but that's what happened with Black Wall Street. O.W. Gurley, who founded the village, I'm going to call it the village, of Greenwood, he built it in, well, he built it in a community that was surrounded by white folks. And both of these incidents are labeled by race. But I'm coloring it something different. My take on what happened, matter of fact, I'm going to do a trifecta here. My take on what happened with Rosewood, what happened with Black Wall Street, the Greenwood District in Tulsa, and what happened to Emmett Till, at its root, in my opinion, based on research and observations today, that they were not racially motivated. Now, they were sold that. The PR on these events was spun that way. But I'm saying that they were all three, the common denominator with all three was based on economics. Two families that controlled the commerce in Rosewood. They controlled the sawmills, the turpentine, the pencil factory, all that. My thing is, you had some people that were of a lower socioeconomic class that happened to be white, that didn't like the prosperity of what blacks were achieving in Rosewood and torched the town based on that economic sabotage. Same thing with Black Wall Street, economic sabotage, and even with Emmett Till, the ruse was, let's say that this kid from out of town that nobody really knows other than, you know, his blood relatives that were in Money, Mississippi, they were initially after the 25 acres of ready-to-harvest cotton when that whole thing went down. Economic sabotage. The ruse in all three incidences that worked back then, and it even works today in 2021 occasionally, is that a black man violated a white woman. It happened with Emmett Till. It happened with Rosewood. It happened with Black Wall Street. Each and every one of them, that was the common denominator, what I call ruse. But at the root of it, in my opinion, it was economic sabotage. spun with the race thing, because the race thing, it would, you know, you need the ruse factor with the, you know, to speed up your, what your particular agenda is. With Black, Black Wall Street. No, with Black Wall Street, the they said the black man violated the white woman elevator operator. They were dating. They were in a relationship, so that didn't happen. But they used it as a ruse to start some shit. The Rosewood Massacre, same thing. A black man was accused of raping a white woman. That was the excuse used, or the ruse used. And, of course, Emmett Till, we already know, you know what that was. On that note, we're going to do another rerun on this Sawmill Towns, but Rosewood was a Sawmill Town, and I'm putting all this out here to say this. You, regardless of what color you are, race you are, whatever, a good strategy in 2021 and beyond is essentially, if you're looking for a way to earn some good money, establish your own town based on an economic engine. Sawmill towns did their thing, and then once the lumber ran out or the trees ran out, you know, those towns ceased to exist because they were specifically started because of, you know, the geographic opportunities that existed. But now you can repurpose those towns, or, you know, just set up your own community, but based on some type of economic engine. And in Levi County, I've been there, now that's wired. So, you know, what kind of community can you set up where you're wired and you'll be, you know, you have a peace of mind, you can raise your kids the way you want to and that type of thing.
Really, the South today is really not much different than the rest of the country. But the Old South, that's another story in what the Rosewood Massacre is all about. 60 years ago, Rosewood in North Florida was a thriving little community of about 200 people, almost all of them black. Early in January 1923, some 1,000 whites came to town, and when they left about a week later, Rosewood had been burned to the ground. No one knows for sure how many people were killed there. The figures might be as high as 40. For 60 years, the story of Rosewood remained secret and was only uncovered recently by Florida newspaper man Gary Moore, who is writing a book on the massacre at Rosewood.
Rosewood. There's a road sign proclaiming its name, but no memorial commemorating its dead. Located 9 miles from the Gulf of Mexico at Cedar Key, Florida, Rosewood today is little more than a trailer park. You search in vain for any sign of a slaughter, for any hint of the mass murder that took place here a long time ago.
Well, what did it look like?
It's a big blaze. You seen things on fire. A big blaze. It's burning down. It's burning up the whole thing. It's burning up my grandmama's house, churches, and everything. They burn up everything we had. All our clothes. And everything. Yeah. They burned it up.
Why did they burn everything?
They was mad.
But you were just little children.
I know it. What did we care? They didn't care. They killed us. I was about 8 years old.
Minnie Lee Langley was only a child when she became a refugee. Now, she's a great-grandmother. At her home in Jacksonville, Florida, we talked to her about the place where she was born, Rosewood, Florida, the place that haunts her memory.
I know they killed my aunt, and they killed my granddaddy. Made my granddaddy dug his hole. He didn't have but one arm, but they made him dug his own grave. And he prayed, and they shot him back within the grave.
At Rosewood?
At Rosewood.
This is where it all began, in the white settlement of Sumner, just a few miles from Rosewood.
Sumner disappeared in the late 1920s when a fire destroyed the sawmill. But back in 1923, Sumner was a booming little company town. James and Fanny Taylor had a home not far from here. On the morning of January 1st, 1923, James Taylor was already at work at the sawmill when neighbors said they heard his wife Fanny screaming for help. Fanny told her neighbors that a man had entered her home and attacked her, a black man.
She opened the door, but he just knocked her down, and she was raped.
Edith Foster was 16 years old at the time. She remembers seeing the few hundred white men of Sumner joined by others from surrounding counties, even from out of state. She remembers how they grew into a mob seeking revenge.
If he hadn't ever went in on this white lady, you know, well, there'd never been nothing to it.
It's not known for sure who attacked Fanny Taylor. Some whites say it was Sylvester Carrier, a young, strong-willed black man from Rosewood. Some blacks say the attacker was a white man. They say it was Fanny Taylor's boyfriend. But a lot of people tend to think the attacker was a black convict who had escaped from a nearby chain gang. Whoever he was, he touched off a week-long killing party.
They just, a bad crew come in here, and they just wiped it off the map.
That night, around about 9 o'clock or 8:30, there they come in a car.
They kept looking for this Sylvester, but they didn't seem to find him. And then they went back up there that night and to talk to his mother.
Called him for my aunt, saying, Sarah, Sarah, Sarah. And so my aunt didn't say nothing because she was scared, too.
And that's when all the shooting began, you see.
And with the shooting all in the house, all upstairs in the windows.
These colored folks, you know, they were ready for it.
And I was sitting right between his legs. And he had the gun over to my right shoulder.
This was Sylvester?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I got down under him. And these old white people busted door down. When they busted door down, that's where he dropped them. He just dropped everyone come to the door.
He shot them?
Yeah.
Well, they killed Mr. Anders before he got to the house. They loaded him with a buckshot right here. Killed him dead. They had to leave him there.
At least two white men were killed that night, forcing the mob to retreat. It was then that the black women and children, 12 or 13 of them, ran from the bullet-riddled Carrier home and into the woods. Minnie Lee Langley, 8 years old at the time, ran with them.
We had a aunt with us, so Scrappy. She was just like a hen with a nest of biddies. She taken us to the woods, kept us out in the woods. She kept us out in the woods almost a week.
There's swamps out there.
Well, we stayed in there. Took her like a soldier and stayed out there in the woods.
You went through those swamps?
Yes, we went all out in the woods. And she built a little bit of fire for us to stay warm because it was so cold at night.
In the morning, the mob returned, several hundred strong. Inside the Carrier home, they found Sarah, Sylvester's mother. She was dead. They also found another body, a black man. Some people say it was Sylvester, but no one really knows for sure. What we do know is what happened next. The mob set the Carrier home on fire, and they watched it burn. And then that mob grew in size, it grew in anger, and it became even more violent.
You ain't never seen a mob like that.
Fred Kirkland was a teenager when he saw the mob rampaging through Rosewood.
They went wild. There were 1,000 to 1,500 people there by that time, and they're coming in from every direction. And they was crazy. They give the high sheriff and the deputy 5 minutes to get out of sight and not come back.
They told the sheriff and the deputy to get out of town and not come back?
Get out of there. Give them 5 minutes to get out of sight.
And what did the sheriff and the deputy do?
They left there. And then they went to burning houses, killing people. You never seen.
Yeah, Sunday morning they came through here, you know, setting houses on fire. And as each one ran out, they'd shoot them, kill them. And there was a colored woman right here, lived just across here in the woods from me. And her name was Lexi Gordon. And she was sick. She had typhoid fever. And she told her, the ones that were staying there with her, for them to go ahead and get away if they could, well, she'd just take whatever come, you know. Well, naturally, when they set the house afire, well, she ran out and ran out towards the back. And she had a back door, Johnny, you know, out there. And so she made for it. And they shot her before she got there.
But she had nothing to do with it
at all, whatever. And, it was a way with a lot of them, you see. That's the reason it was such a situation that we just couldn't understand. It was just a mad bunch of men come in here.
What do you think they got out of it? Why did they do it?
Motive, I guess. Satisfaction is all I can figure it out. I don't know what it was.
Satisfaction.
I reckon that was it.
Well, the whole place was in smoke around here, you know. And they said they had destroyed all the buildings. And said that there would be no more to live here no more, you know. They couldn't let come back and live.
Miss Langley, would you go back to Rosewood with us?
I would go if y'all don't let them bother me or nothing like that. I don't want to go there and get hurt or nothing.
Yeah.
You remember?
Hello, darling.
We brought Minnie Lee Langley back to Rosewood for the first time in 60 years. We also asked Lee Ruth Davis, Leroy Carrier, and Sam Hall, all survivors of Rosewood, to come back for a day.
Oh. Hello, Sammy.
Hey. You remember her, Mr. Hall?
Yeah. Oh, she looked just up for this Morrison.
Yeah. Oh, Lord, yeah. This is Morrison.
Was that they used to call you?
That's what they called me, Morrison.
You looked just like Miss Virginia.
Yeah,
your mama.
My mother.
Yeah.
I'm bringing back memories that I wished I could get rid of. You know what I mean? This has been a holiday. If you just had been here to listen to all this and see some of it, then you would have known just what it was.
What
we lost everything.
Lost everything.
You own the land.
Yeah, we own our land, all of them.
And no one ever paid you any money for this land?
No.
Just lost it.
Took it.
What do you say to children today? Children like this boy, like your great-grandson, and people who didn't grow up when you grew up,
mm-hmm.
and people who didn't go through what you went through, people who would say, this couldn't have happened in this country. Come on.
I would tell them like this. I said, don't ever stay in a place that white folks can surround it. Don't never stay in a place that white folks can surround it. Because if anything happens somewhere else, they'll run you out from your home just like they did us.
Not many whites lived in Rosewood at that time, really just a handful. Among the few who did live here was a man by the name of John Wright, who owned the general store. John Wright lived in this house. It's one of the few that has survived. To blacks in Rosewood, John Wright was a hero. He opened his home to many of the women and children who were hiding from that mob. And John Wright did even more. He was able to get a message to the railroad that said, the town is on fire, send a train. And that's how many blacks escaped from Rosewood, by train. Who was on the train? You were on the train?
I was on the train. I'll never forget it. It was night when the train come there. It was 4 o'clock. When we left, Mr. Wright.
4 o'clock in the morning?
That's right. And he told them, conductor, to pull the train on the stop anywhere on the road that he saw women's and children, but not maids, because they didn't know who the maids would be.
If it hadn't been for this house.
We wouldn't have been here, because we wouldn't have had nowhere to hide.
Rosewood. You won't find an accurate account of it in any history book. Yet, about 40 people were killed here one terrifying week 60 years ago. When you think about it, far greater atrocities have happened elsewhere in the world. But Rosewood belongs to America. It's a real American horror story. The wonder is that it stayed secret so long. Minnie Lee Langley never even told her family.
I didn't want them to know that I was scouting through the woods to stay out there all night long, out there in that coal and all that stuff. I didn't
running for your life?
Run, trying to save my life. I didn't want them to know just what how I come along, you know, through all of this and what the white folks had did to us, because I thought it was really mean. What they did to us was mean, and did it without a cause.